Yes, I was intending to go to the mission field. That's why I was doing medicine. And then I had this illness. And Mr. Still wrote, I think, 5 lines to me when I was in hospital. I still have that letter because it was, in fact, the most perceptive of all the letters which I received and the things that were said to me at that time when it was thought I was going to die. Well, because my illness stopped me going abroad, because no one would insure my life, no one thought I was going to live very long. It took me 20 years before they gave me an insurance policy without extra bits added on one way or another. And then they gave me an ordinary one, and it was extraordinary. I'd always looked upon myself as living on borrowed time. But the sense of being released from the land of the provisionally living to the land of the really living completely took me by surprise. I had not really reflected on it. Well, here I am 40 years later, and in the last, well, for 20 years I've taught people from Africa, the French-speaking Africa, and in the last 6 years have spent several weeks every year teaching in India, theological students there, ministers there, and so on. And I think the kind of ministry I've been asked to participate in is actually helping those who are ministering. And that is something which I think I've looked upon as a tremendous privilege. My wife says I always come alive when I'm speaking to ministers and those who are in ministry. And maybe that's why. Because there's a deep longing in me to enable you to be more effective in your ministries. When I went to do medicine, the person who led me to the Lord, Jimmy Meeklejohn, said to me, "Monty, I always thought you ought to be a minister of the Church of Scotland." And someone else whom I greatly honoured and owe much to, my spiritual life, said, "Oh, why put your wag your power from a pulpit? Don't you want to go and do something useful like being a doctor?" So here were these two people who I owed much to, who had very different guidance for me. I never felt the compulsion on me to become a minister of the Church of Scotland in the sense of taking ordination. And I think you'd be the first to say, never become a minister unless there's a real compulsion laid upon you. And yet, so much of my life has been spent actually ministering to those who minister. God's ways are His ways, and we never know how He will lead us. Our task is to be faithful where we are. Well, I was asked to give this talk on the subject of growing together with your congregation. And now I'm speaking as a member of a congregation. And I'm reminded, just to begin with, that the ministry of word and sacrament is not a profession. It is a vocation, a calling. And yet it does have some features which are in common with other professions. There's a training, there's an expertise which you have, there is special knowledge which you profess. And therefore changes in professional life generally today are going to impinge upon expectations of being a minister and of a congregation's expectations of you, and to some extent the expectations of yourselves. And the sort of thing that you find nowadays in professional life is the kind of phrase that there's an optimum time for doing a job of work. Something like 7 years. In 7 years you can do an effective job, and then you need a change. Sometimes a total career change, but certainly a new location. And I remember one headmaster saying that he was training people now not for one career, but for 2 careers, even 3 careers in their lives. And of course, increasingly you hear people saying, you know, that you will go from one charge to another charge. And it is the Archbishop of Canterbury who is trying to get rid of the freehold of the Anglican ministry so that you have 5-year contracts. And no longer can you stay within that parish unless the bishop decides that it is right you should do so. Now, that hasn't come, but he, I think, was deeply influenced by some of the things he saw in one of the dioceses in England before he became archbishop, which made him feel he ought to change this. But there is a certain push within the professions to this attitude of all change. And the idea of career development is creeping in. And theological colleges now have special sessions for discussing career development of their theological teachers. Might not be a bad idea in Scotland too, but there we are. Curates are certainly trained with this idea of career development. Nurses, doctors, likewise. Managers, of course, especially. And the idea of a job for life, and certainly being in the same place for life, is something which is certainly under attack, and the Sheehy report with regard to the police is just a fairly recent example of the kind of thinking being brought to bear upon professions. The idea of vocation is increasingly becoming obsolete. And what you do is you give what you've got, and then you move on to give what you've got. And when I think of an example in Banffshire, I think it was the Milne dynasty in the Church of Scotland there, there was 137 years of one family ministering to that community, grandfather, father and son. And each of them had a ministry extending over 40 years. I don't advocate that as the sort of thing that we should look for, but there was very much a sense of this almost Levitical family being committed to the task of ministry. Now, change may be good, but I always think of one quotation where a particular person said, "We are constantly on exercises, we are being reorganized, ceaselessly encouraged to learn new methods which are then abandoned. It's a wonderful way for keeping us busy with the illusion of progress." Gaius Petronius, 500 BC or something. So the title of growing together with your congregation may sound almost an anachronism today. It gives the idea of being stuck, of being fossilized, even of being reactionary. And in educational circles today, the clever speak is, you're not attached to someone for training, but you're exposed to things for experiencing. And what kind of doctors you're going to get at the end of the day, I cannot say. Now, I don't expect you to be happy with that kind of thing, but I want to ask you, have you really thought through the issues, or do you just react to those issues? And there are lots of things which I'd like to tackle with you with regard to ministry, but my remit is to stick to that of growing relationship of the minister and his congregation. In fact, it's just this week that I saw the first clergy husband suffering from a depression arising out of his wife's ministry. So this is something which we're going to get more of. I've seen lots and lots of wives of ministers reacting and being depressed in relation to their husband's ministry, but it's already started the other one. Okay, what about our growing relationship with our congregation? And the first thing I want to say especially here is, our ministry is not to our congregation. Now, I may have colluded in the title, I'm not sure, but it's not our congregation. Our ministry is our contribution to the building up of a particular fellowship of God's people. And we are talking of our involvement in the context of a succession of ministries to that fellowship. My own experience was I was brought up in a village just south of Glasgow, the parish of Eaglesham. A village in those days of about 1,000 people. And there were two churches, the old UF church and the old parish kirk. The manses were well outside the village. so that they didn't have to hobnob with the hoi polloi. They had long ministries, and I remember one godly old man saying that the two ministers in my time had left the village pagan between them. Bob McMahon, who's here, often did pulpit supply in the vacancies before they managed to get the union. It was certainly not a happy experience. My next experience of parish ministry or being in parish was an inner city parish in Dundee, the Steeple, where there'd been a union of two churches, and there's been a series of three ministers who've contributed to the changes over the last 35 years. But most of my time has been spent in a parish in England, an Anglican parish, where I spent almost 30 years as a member of this congregation. My wife had a longer association, with a break, of course, when she was in Scotland with me. And over 45 years, one has seen a change from the vicar who went around with gaiters and a top hat and handing out his visiting card, and I'm talking of the 1940s, to a situation where one of the staff wears earrings. I mean, male member of staff. And at that time, 40-odd years ago, there were two Anglican congregations, almost total hostility to each other. One of the buildings had been bombed, and the bishop refused them permission to rebuild, so they just had to get into the one building. And as I look at what has happened, is there's been a succession of three ministries during those 45 years. And the first minister loved those two congregations into being one fellowship. The second minister instructed that fellowship into being a growing fellowship. He was mainly a preacher. And the third minister motivated that fellowship into being a caring, outward-looking, and giving fellowship. And I think whatever each one of them has done, they have built upon what the other has done before. And it was that that made me feel very strongly, when we come to a fellowship, we must be clear where we're coming into the life of that fellowship and how that fellowship will fare when we leave. We should have a vision for our fellowship, but we should leave a fellowship which has a vision for us and for how they themselves should progress. So it is our congregation, yes, but entrusted to our care. They are the Lord's people given to us for a longer or a shorter time to love, to instruct, to encourage in the ways of the Lord. Now, what is our vision for a congregation? I think we should ask ourselves that. What's our goal? What are we aiming for? It's Michael Griffiths in his excellent little book written many years ago called Cinderella with Amnesia, who says a church is not a segregation of people we like, but a congregation of people whom God has brought together and told them to love each other. Not a segregation of people we like, but a congregation of people whom God has brought together and told to love each other. And so often, when we think of the success of a ministry, we say, well, we've left a self-sufficient church, or we've managed to get through the building project, and the steeple's now looking beautiful, and everybody comes to look at it, or whatever it is. Yeah. It's all right, we had a steeple that was falling down as well. And the building of that, and saying, do we need to build it again? And the response of the congregation to that was certainly one of the highlights of our congregational life as well. And we didn't go to English Heritage or any of these bodies either. Sorry, I didn't say that. And it reminds me of somebody who spoke of a dying minister who was asked what were his thoughts as he was leaving this earth. He said, my thought that constantly goes round and round in my mind is, does my congregation love each other? That was his goal for his congregation. That there should be a congregation, a fellowship of people who loved each other, that reflected the life of Christ within them. I want to read from a book which I picked up just the other day, actually, The Trials of a Country Parson, by somebody called, believe it or not, Augustus Jessop, D.D., the rector of Scarning in Norfolk. And he says this: "The circumstances under which I recommenced residence in my country parish were, unhappily, not conducive to my forming a favorable judgment of my people. I was, at starting, brought face to face with the worst side of their characters. They were, and had for a long time, been in bad hands. They had surrendered themselves to the guidance of those who had gone very far towards demoralizing them. I could not be blind to the faults, the vices, if you will, which were only too apparent. I could not but grieve at the altered tone which was observable in their language and their manners since the days when I had been a country curate 20 years before. But while I lamented the noticeable deterioration, and the fact that the people were less cordial, less courteous, less generous, less loving, and therefore less happy than they had been, I gradually got to see that the surface may be ruffled, and yet the inner nature beneath that surface may have some depths unaffected by the turmoil. The charity which hopeth all things suggested that it was the time to work and wait. It was not long before I learnt to feel something more than mere interest in my people. I learned to love them." And then he goes on to say, "I hold that any clergyman in a country parish, and I would say any parish, who aims exclusively at being a religious teacher will miss his aim. He must be more, or he will fail to be that." Now, David Searle, as he was talking about preaching yesterday, "Preaching should be steeped in prayer and delivered in the power of the Spirit, because it's that which changes minds and hearts and will." With that I agree. But I think I would like to say, and I know David would say, that we need preaching which is theology on fire, but on fire coming out of a love for those to whom we preach. 1 Corinthians 14. You find the words again and again of instruction, edification, understanding. The chapter's full of references to that, the mind being involved. But chapter 14 follows chapter 13. I was once asked by a theological student, "What on earth would a person like you want for me if you were in a congregation that I was minister of?" And at the time I said, "I would wish you to help me apply the Word of God to every part of my life and work." I should have added, and would now add, "And you will have to become part of us to do so. You will have to become part of us, belong to us, and love us for that really to become effective." And while I don't disagree with what David said, on the contrary, I go along with what he said, I think this is the dimension which sometimes we forget. In my village where I was brought up, people knew each other. They gossiped about each other. Anything which was a feather at the bottom of the village became a feather bed at the top of the village. But when it came to a union between those churches, they could well have been Bosnian Serbs and Muslims. And there was a long interregnum. But the ministers may have earned the respect in measure. And I suppose they loved their people. But one of them used to walk up the middle of the street. There wasn't actually in those days a road which went right through the village. It was a dead end pretty well. He used to walk up the middle of the street so he didn't have to stop and say hello to people. He used to just take off his hat, you know, like this. And people laughed. But those ministers never gave themselves to the people, far less to each other's people. And there was a dependency on the ministers, but no concept of sharing between the ministers and people, or between each other. Now, the people in congregations know their minister's weaknesses. They suspect the minister's needs, but they never expect to care for their ministers. And I do wonder if that loving of one another, which is at the heart, I think, of our learning to grow along with our congregations, I wonder if that can ever be the hallmark of a fellowship, except where the needs, the weaknesses of ministers are seen and responded to by the minister exploring and exposing something of that to them. And unless the ministers themselves are prepared to expose themselves in loving and being loved, they may remain excellent professional counselors, but I wonder whether they'll ever become pastors who love their people and are loved by them. I think of one minister in the city where I used to work who came to his church and within a matter of just 2 or 3 weeks became mentally ill, had to go into the local psychiatric hospital. And then, of course, when he came out, he had to get back up into his pulpit and take over. And the whole congregation, see, you know, parson's been bonkers. And they watched him. And when he left after some years, one of the office bearers of the church said, "You know what your illness did for us? It transformed us from being a professional congregation into being a caring fellowship." Now, Christ committed himself to all sorts of people. The women of Caesar's household for money. Martha and Mary for fellowship and food. Peter and Judas, who betrayed him. I think it was Mr. Still himself who said once, or wrote once, "If Christ shared and committed himself to people like Peter and Judas, who are we to stand aloof and apart? Can we ever learn to love each other? Can we ever belong to each other unless something of us is shared and exposed to each other as we learn to grow together?" And I never forget my own experience of being convicted as a pastor shared his own fears, uncertainties, and discouragements with me. And I realized I hadn't really supported him, prayed for him, offered my personal support until he shared this with me. But you know, it takes time to work through to that degree of mutual trust. It was Rollo May, a psychologist, who, talking about marital breakups and relationships and so on, said, "You know, the problem is that these people never stayed with each other long enough to learn what it was to love each other. They never stayed with each other long enough to learn what it was to love each other." I wonder what sometimes motivates people to move. What constitutes a call to another charge? To a more important charge, which we call strategic. Well, it may be. A more challenging and larger responsibility. Ah, but there's an assistant attached to that one. To more opportunities. Yes, it's nearer 1-2-1. There's a job for the wife and schools for the kids. Now, it's not wrong, and it often is right, that one should move. But I wonder how honest we are with ourselves, even more with the people who've been entrusted to our care. Because there are, in the minds of many parishes, the idea that there are one-star parishes and there are five-star parishes. In Dundee, where I was, there was the amalgamation of two congregations, and one was certainly self-regarding and looked upon itself as being a five-star parish. After all, they had produced two moderators in the last umpteen years, whatever it was. You know, parishes do understand, tolerate, and adapt. But my own view is that we should re-examine the value of long-term ministries. Maybe there has to be a first charge and then a move. But up and down the land, and this goes for Scotland and England, I'm sure, there are bereaved parishes. There are hurt people. They feel inferior people because ministers never stay. They feel wounded because they've been stirred up and given expectations and then abandoned and left in the lurch. They've never really felt they've been related to by a minister. And they become withdrawn. They become guarded. They cling to their old ways. They're resistant to change. How can they trust themselves again to a series of short timers? I remember there was a young psychiatrist that I was training who wanted to be a psychotherapist and was very gifted and had a lot of flair. And he took on this very difficult young woman, and I was for a more cautious way of handling her because she was quite a challenging, testing out individual. But no, he really wanted to go at it. And I said, all right, off you go, you try. And he really was making a lot of headway. And then she began to sort of really act up. She began to test him out. She began to challenge him. She began to really put him through his paces as a therapist. And he came to the ward round one day and said, I think this woman needs a new therapist. I said, oh, no, you don't. You're going to stay with her. You gave her expectations that you were going to see her through these difficulties. You must now extricate yourself from your own difficulty. I'm here to support you, but you go back. And all credit to him, he did, and did well with her. Now, sometimes a congregation needs a short-term situation. A specific job has to be done. Someone needs to come in as a catalyst for change and for stimulus. But hit and run ministries leave wounded and broken congregations, and very often result in immature ministers who themselves never really grow up and learn and never grow spiritually or in the ministries. Now, in a fellowship like this, I suppose I'm speaking to the converted, I don't know. You certainly have got some examples of longer ministries around. I'm interested in how frequently such ministries within Scotland and in England are associated with the minister being single. And I wonder whether this is because within that there is an acknowledgement of their own vulnerability and their dependence upon the fellowship and interdependence. I'll leave them to comment on that if they wish. But such ministries, because they are longer term, do have potential for innovation and growth. And not only a growing together of minister and congregation, but a growth of the congregation in terms of its ability to think new thoughts, do new things, explore a new way of witnessing and declaring the Lord whom we serve. Now, so as not to be invidious, may I turn to England for examples here. I think of John Stott, born within the parish where he still resides, who was curate in All Souls, then rector, then emeritus rector, and still is very much associated with that fellowship. I have no doubt that part of what All Souls has been able to contribute to the Anglican Church and to the world at large, because of the things which have been explored there and done there, not just come from John Stott, but because of the length of the ministry there, which has changed and adapted and been an example of how a congregation did grow close to its pastor and its pastor to it. It was a very fashionable, pretty dead West End parish when he first went there as a curate. Very different now. Dick Lucas, some of you know. Again, there's this church, this medieval pile in the middle of city of London, surrounded by skyscrapers, offices and banks and so on. But because of a commitment of one person there and a growing congregation growing with him, it has become a resource centre from which you draw as well. Going closer to Bristol, I think of a church known as Pip and Jay. Some of you may have heard of it. St. Philip's and St. Jacob's, a rather charismatic church. But it's a church because, again, of the commitment of one person to that fellowship, there has been a growing, not only in pastor and congregation, but in the way in which that congregation has responded to the challenge of ministry. And in Christchurch, the one where we have been associated for several years, here's a true parochial situation, rooted in a locality. The vicar, no one's heard of him. Who's heard of Paul Berg? He's not a popular preacher. He says he was never offered anything else after he came to Christchurch. But he has trained 30 ministers, only two of whom perhaps have had major problems. Not bad, out of 30 curates or assistants. Produced two bishops, rescued a theological college, pioneered Christian Basics, which some people call Agnostics Anonymous and so on, from which perhaps 50 to 100 people become Christians every year, something scattered now throughout the whole of England anyway. In each parish where it's conducted, many people become Christians. Pioneered psalm praise, and as a church now, we support something like about 40 people in some measure in Christian work throughout the world. 20 years ago, £1,000 was the Christian giving to missions. Now it's near £200,000. 20 years ago, £4,000 was the diocesan quota. I suppose you were maintenance ministry and all the rest of it. Now it's 150, pushing 200,000. The congregation has increased, but not much. 500 members 20 years ago, 900, some of whom are also members of other churches, because there are a number of students who have dual membership. Now, some long-term ministries have used fellowships. Some have destroyed fellowships. Sometimes they've not destroyed them, but the minister has lost any sense of ongoing call and vision, and I'm talking even of evangelical ministers here, and they've just remained long-term. But if I had to analyze and comment upon why some long-term ministries seem to produce that growing together, which then allows a growing of the whole work and ministry of that church, if I look at it from a human point of view, I would have to reduce it to the fact that it seems to me in those churches one often finds a team. There's a team approach, but a team that shares and a team that prays. For us to grow with our congregations, there must be some concept or some experience of having a team around us. A feeling that we're in this together. May I quote from Mr. Still in his Work of the Pastor? These words struck me many years ago as being prophetic. The point is that no man can preach effectively on his own. Unless he can find help and guidance to relate himself to some group somewhere, who are prepared to own him and who will care for him and prepare to thrust him forth into the battle, he cannot do it. Until he finds himself in his first charge, perhaps, and discovers that his people, all unknown to him, had been fishing in all waters for him. Until up he came, and both fish and fisher said with delight, "Hello. I was looking for you." Done in his own inimitable style, but I think that would be the experience of most of those who felt that they've really grown together with their congregation, and where the congregation has grown as well. Because isolation in the ministry is deadly. And there must be somebody, or somebody, sharing, supporting, praying, and enabling. It's not going to come from 121 George Street. They can give a lot of support, no doubt, and other things too, perhaps. Fraternals are hopeless. You know, I often go to ministers' groups and so on, and even diocesan evangelical fellowships, which would be the nearest thing you have to Creef in England. And you go around and they're all saying, and how's the Lord doing it? How's your congregation doing? How are things doing? Oh, the Lord is blessing wonderfully, yes. Things are encouraging. Yeah, slow but sure, you know. And I never forget one group of missionaries. In France, it was the 50th anniversary of a particular theological college. And there they had 300 missionaries from all over the French-speaking world, and they were saying how the Lord was blessing here, there, and everywhere, and so on. And then I spoke on the subject of depression in the Christian worker. And for the rest of that week, my wife and I did not have a spare moment as we dealt with one person, couple, after another. She doing the translating where the person couldn't speak English. And the very person whom we'd spoken to before and said, yes, the Lord was blessing, came the next day and said, actually, it's not like that. I'm profoundly depressed and feel absolutely burnt out. Bishops are supposed to help and do sometimes, but often when the situation has gone too far. And Creef, yes, you have this time of praying and sharing. There's an encouragement, no doubt about that. Many people have said that. But beware of becoming dependent upon that. You should be looking for the support from your own fellowship, if at all possible. Because when you depend upon this, maybe you're not looking for the potential for growing together with your fellowship. It can sometimes encourage you in feeling them and me, rather than saying, come, I'm sent out from here to go with a new vision for enabling them to care for me and for me to learn to love them better. Now, I'm not saying that necessarily is the case. I'm just saying there is that danger. There was an article about 2 years ago by a chap called Peterson. And I don't know, I can't remember whether it was in the magazine called Leadership, which I don't get, but somebody drew my attention to, or whether it was Christianity Today. But anyway, this was a Canadian Presbyterian minister in a mission church where he had ministered for 29 years. And because it was a mission church, he had to produce statistics every year to the central office. And there was, in fact, a section in his annual report which had the comments, personal comments from the minister. And he never ever had any feedback from his 26 years of giving statistics and also his personal comments. So, I think 27th year, under personal comments he put, I have lost my faith. No response. Year, he put, I'm involved in a sexual relationship with another woman. With a woman. No comment. 3rd year, thank you for your support. I am now leaving the ministry. And the response came back immediately. Why are you leaving the ministry? What's the problem? Why didn't you tell us earlier? And he wrote, for 29 years, I have waited. Given you my statistics, and no one has sat down and discussed my situation with me. We need to find, create, enable a team, ideally from the fellowship where we minister. I think it was Paul Berg who once said to me, I want to be friends with everybody. And we must try to be friends with everybody. But there will be some special friends with whom we share, especially. And wasn't it Jesus himself? It was known which women contributed out of their pocket money given by their husbands. It was known which home he went to when he needed to rest. It was known which garden he went to when he wanted to pray on his own. And it was known that there was one of his disciples whom he loved specially. You see, many congregations want a minister who can share. Not only share themselves, but share a vision with them. And even if they can't articulate that themselves, they wouldn't put it in those words. Nevertheless, they are able to catch a vision which the minister can share with them. You know the difference between a fantasy and a vision. Many ministers have a fantasy of how they think God is going to work. The difference between a vision and a fantasy is the fantasy is something which you keep in a little cupboard. And when nobody else is watching, you open the door and you take it out and you polish it and say, isn't it lovely? Put it back again so nobody can see. You're going to be a great preacher. You're going to really build up this church. You know, people are going to get converted or whatever it is. But a vision is something which is shared, open for evaluation, open for criticism, open for modification. But it has to be presented in a way which a congregation can grasp. Now this means that you've got to find those whom you can trust, those with whom you can share your vision, maybe just a little bit to start with. And you don't look for yes men and women. You look for those who can think along with you and challenge you. You know, as a consultant in my psychiatric team, we had our regular meetings for patient review. But we also had those other meetings when we met and had lunch together, sandwich, coffee and so on, just to discuss how the team was working, where we were going as a team, what we were doing. Not a decision-making body, but an area where they could come and say, look, I don't think this is working very well. Or look, we don't see much of you. You're too often in France and India and places like that, and so on. And then you have to say, right, this is what I'm doing. This is, I need your support here, etc. In our own fellowship, forgive me to be being personal here, but a lot of my thinking has come out of what we have seen over the years. We have a leadership team in Christchurch. We don't have elders. I know some Anglican churches have people they call elders, but they're not elders in the Scottish sense, and our own vicar feels, why call them something that they aren't? They're just called church leadership team. It's not the whole church council. There are some people from the church council, some people co-opted. But it grew and developed over the years, and initially was a group who met for prayer and discussion with the vicar. It has now become the church wardens and assistant wardens with the lay readers and the staff. And others co-opted for special reasons. And sometimes there is no consensus as we discuss matters. Sometimes we're directly at variance. And sometimes the vicar has brought things that he feels we ought to do, and the church leadership has said, no, we don't think this is right. And there will be a discussion. We've never voted. But there's a sense of involvement, a sense of accountability. And out of that has come the affirmation, caution, sometimes constructive exploration of material brought by the vicar. And I think much of the strategic thinking must come from the minister. But by sharing it in this way, then there is an accountability and most often a constructive exploration of where we go with it. And we've talked about things like preaching. We've had feedback on preaching. How many of you actually have a group of people who actually give you feedback on your preaching? What they've learnt, what they felt, you know, I think Paul Berg put it this way. On one side of the cardboard, of the piece of paper, you can put things that were good, things that were less helpful. Something about content and so on. It's not just negative. It must be positive and corrective as well. Leadership. Who really, we all feel, have gifts within the church. When it comes to giving, how should this be discussed with the fellowship? How should we teach on giving? How should we allocate the giving? When it comes to missionary support, whom should we espouse and support and pray for? When it comes to music, how do we evaluate what is good music? I wanted a hymn, you see. And I thought it was a wonderful hymn to start off with. And Jim said, I don't know how I can play that. And Mr. Still said, oh, these modern tunes. Forgive me. I thought it was wonderful, but there we are. I bowed to my seniors. But we need to have that kind of evaluation. Eventually, we started to have minutes, because there was just a hint that people felt this was a little in-group that was doing everything. So there's a note put in the church magazine of what has been discussed. Now, that doesn't mean everything is put in that note, but at least the congregation knows there is a body, and these are the matters they were discussing. There is a summary put for the church council, equivalent of your Kirk session or deacon's board or whatever. But all decisions are brought to the church council. We meet fortnightly. We share. We pray. Discuss. And have an open agenda. Now, there are difficulties and there are dangers in that sort of approach. But if we can't bend with our people, then we will be left on our own. If we can't trust our people, how can they trust us? With us and for us. You know, we may have some real surprises when it comes to this. I was struck by Colossians chapter 4, where Paul speaks of his support group, those who pray for him. And do you remember John Mark is the one who says, oh, do send John Mark to me. He's such a tremendous help. He really knows my needs. John Mark? John Mark? The chap that Paul said, no way am I going with him. He let me down once, never again. Oh, John Mark, that lovely man. He really knows how I tick. Do send him to me. There are some prizes for us if we're open to the fact the Spirit of God can work in us and in other people as well. A team that shares, and a team that prays. I did discuss some of the content of this with my own minister before I came. And he stated that at the end of the day, he felt it was the meeting for prayer, the meetings for prayer, which he felt at the heart of our growing together as a fellowship. Now I can hear loud amens. But I would plead that there are many different ways in which this can be done. 20 years ago, the only meeting for prayer in our church was 4 or 5 people who used to meet before an evening service. Today, maybe something like 600 people meet in 60 different locations, scattered over Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday. Membership of 900. There are 6 people meet on a Tuesday morning at 7 o'clock in the morning with the vicar. Everyone is welcome. There are 100 people who meet to have breakfast first and then pray between 9 and 10 in the morning on a Saturday, once a month. And the church leaders will pray every fortnight for half an hour before our discussion. There is much more prayer than that. But these are the times which are quite clearly allocated. Now, how it's done, I don't think I feel very strongly about. So long as it does happen, that there are those opportunities, and that we should enable it to happen in a way which is most appropriate to the kind of fellowship which we have. There must be flexibility. There will be change. But to have those times of prayer which are supervised, informed, and expectant. That will give evidence of, and also be productive of, a minister and congregation growing together. I want to draw to a halt and just reiterate, we are in a succession of ministries. We must be prepared to love, be seen to love, and to be loved, so we can learn to love each other. We should be prepared when in difficulties, not to take that as a sign to move away, but as a challenge to move on through the difficulties with our fellowship. And we can only grow with our congregation as we share our vision. Demonstrate that we're in a joint enterprise. That's what koinonia means. Because Willie Barclay makes much of that, maybe too much. But it's a joint enterprise. And enable the fellowship to be a part of the team with us. Enabling them to develop their gifts and the ministry which God has given them. Let me just finally quote from another poem. From a poem, rather. It's called Our Parish Minister. And it begins, as he was, he knew his country parish door by door. My kindly minister of ancient days, among the lonely dwellings of the poor, his frequent footstep called for frequent praise. A cultured man of large outlook and deep, yet quaintly narrowed, as we call it now, the souls and secrets of his flock to keep in sacred trust was all his sacred vow. His pious elders slept in different pews. They lent him casual aid about the kirk, wise greybeard, sound and solemn in their views. He led them wisely, and they loved the work. He preached damnation to our homely sins, in fiery language mercifully restrained. Was eloquent betimes of love that wins the vagrant soul where unclean spirits reigned. But powerful groanings of the human race in distant deserts or in crowded town ne'er touched the placid thinking on his face, or dimmed the glory of the golden crown. No pulpit pleading over sordid things, no mixing money with the sacred call. The world was governed by the King of Kings. He tended one small portion, that was all. Small and parochial was his narrow mind, and spite of culture, haply you may say. Sweet soul, benevolent and kind, I loved him then, and honour him today. The second part of the program is, as he is. He lives and moves in spiritual unrest. Our eager parish pastor of today exists by constant stirrings of the nest with little leisure or to think or pray. Large schemes to renovate mankind en masse and smaller ones for Sunday school and choir, propounded from his lectern of brass with equal warmth his loving breast inspire. With all an earnest soul of high desire, compact of stronger clay than common men, and conscious of a certain inner fire urging to labor with a strength of 10. For swarms of yellow rascals in the east, for hot zenanas in the torrid zone, his nervous people pliantly afleece to win a glory to the world unknown. Hallmarked for preaching by a college course, they placed him here an hungry flock to feed. Now countless duties dissipate the force, conserve no more for mere parochial need. Of course he takes kind note of every pew, remembers well the lonely lives at home, nor yet unmindful of the wretched few who neither come to church nor care to come. For sick ones he has shown a tender care, and grieves he cannot know his parish more, right gladly heed his scanty comfort share in flannel benefits to help the poor. But sympathies are wider nowadays. The wretched world persists with larger claim, and so our pious pastor works and prays his soul out with our parish. All the same. That was written in 1900 by someone who I think was the father of Meg Buchanan, who was Mrs. McCoffey of the McFlannels. But note, the minister, it's the dislike of change and the discomfort of challenge and the security of the narrow parochialism that comes out of that particular poem. Okay, we don't identify with that. But it also speaks of a sense of being loved by the one and not loved and belonging to the other.
Come on. You're on your mettle. Are there some ministers who temperamentally, their makeup make it difficult for them to share themselves? They can share a certain amount, but beyond that, temperamentally, they find it very awkward and embarrassing to allow people really close in return.
You see, I think that goes for everyone. Did you hear the question? Are there some people who temperamentally find it difficult to share? They get embarrassed about sharing beyond a certain level. Is that right? Yeah, you don't like people getting close. Yeah, I think my own feeling is that goes for all of us in some measure. And one of the most effective people I know in terms of making contact with strangers is one of the shyest people I know. And his comment was, I feel so shy that I am embarrassed about going up to somebody. He said, but maybe they feel just the same. So maybe I ought to take the first move. And of course, that's the difference. Many people say, I'm shy, I can't do it, it's not me, and they never grow. They remain shy, and that's them, and that remains them. Now, if that's what you think about yourself, that's what you're communicating to everybody else. So how on earth can people grow if you're saying, I am shy, I know you're shy, so let's just leave it at that, shall we? I mean, isn't that the logical outcome? If you're prepared to say, look, I find this very difficult, but I'm aware of how shy other people are, maybe people say, oh, goodness, he feels shy too, does he? Oh, poor man. You know, and they come and support him. Now, I've seen that happen. We actually say hello to each other occasionally in church. I used to dread it. We have come to the time in our service when we actually just turn to our neighbour and introduce ourselves. Precisely. Absolutely. I cannot agree with you more. And I just shrink up. I don't mind it, you see, in a professional situation. If I have a lectern between me and you, that's great. If the table between me and you, that's great. But put me beside you and I'm really quite shy. And I used to hate it. And then I found time after time after time, just that opening meant he was somebody who was maybe in church for the first time. I mean, maybe that's special to our church. He was somebody who really was going through a very difficult time. They'd just been bereaved. And the comment was, now you've had a few words with each other, I hope you'll now continue to chat to each other after the service is over. And I felt convicted. I still don't like it. I'm a Scot, come on.
I know.
And there are many Scots within our congregation as well. I do not think you can retreat behind the national stereotypes.
I think you can.
Sandy, there are some Scots who are more awkward than others. That's true.
It's requiring people to do it that's embarrassing. If you can teach people to do that.
Okay.
Without giving them an order from the pulpit.
Right.
Will you agree?
Right. No, I would accept that entirely, so long as they do it.
Yes.
And that's the important thing. And maybe, I was saying, there is a special situation where we have so many strangers who do come. It's a church where a lot of non-Christians do come for one reason or another. But there are some women who... I remember one old lady who just sat and said, I'm not going to speak, you know. But, you know, I don't mind. So long as you don't retreat behind, we're Scots, we don't do it. I'm shy, therefore I don't do it, or whatever. Have I said enough? I don't care how you do it. You can teach them to do it. You can enable them. You can't force them to do it, even when you tell them. Some people won't. But I was convicted as to how often that really was the beginning, the opening, for a real pastoral situation. Now, that's my own experience.
I can think of a number of examples in our congregation where a lonely soul has come in and sat beside someone and spoken to one another and become firm friends, friendship has lasted for years.
Yes.
Absolutely marvellous.
Yeah.
Can I say something else?
I'm sure you can. Yeah.
You said something about the minister letting his congregation know his faults.
Well, they see his faults. Yes, go ahead.
Well, but he may think they do not. But the reason why he wouldn't want them to know some of his faults was to be afraid that what the congregation would think.
Yes.
That's difficult, isn't it?
Yes. I mean, may I elaborate? Now, I do not think myself there's the place for sort of, you know, letting all hang out from the pulpit. I mean, there are some people who I think embarrassingly spew out their insides in front of everybody. And I cannot see that that's appropriate. And I cannot see there's the place for letting all hang out in one big go either. That was very much a sort of fashion in the sort of 60s, 70s coming over from the States, and to some extent with a certain sort of charismatic influence elsewhere. But on the other hand, I think there has to be that looking for the appropriate time and opportunity, not missing a situation where that can be done. And it's the openness and preparedness to be vulnerable, which is what I'm commenting on. And you cannot do it with everybody, because if you share this, with, to some extent, you're making other people responsible for it in a way which would be inappropriate. But the professional, you see, doesn't share his weaknesses. I remember, I may have said this to you on a previous occasion, somebody coming in at the end of a long session, one of my patients, who was really doing very well, and he said, "How are you?" And I said, "I'm a bit tired." And he looked absolutely terror-struck. "Don't you get depressed," he said. And all I'd said was I was a bit tired. It was 7 o'clock in the evening. So the professional doesn't share, and people don't want to know. You're not in that business, it seems to me. So there has to be some sharing, but that must be wisely conducted and perhaps selectively so. David, do you want to?
Well, I was going to put in a slightly different way, really, what you just said. Graham making the point that some people are reserved, and there's no question about it, there are introverts as well as extroverts. But there are a series of concentric circles, aren't there? And there's so much one can share with one or two trusted people, mm-hmm. and a little bit more with perhaps a slightly wider circle and the prayer fellowship, and a little bit more with the whole congregation. And one has to have discretion in that. And I think admitting one's faults to a certain extent is so important in the ministry, because what has amazed me is that even reasonably mature Christians can think that there are two levels of Christianity and Christian living, and that somehow the minister is way up there and he's arrived. And our whole doctrine of sanctification that we're teaching depends on being honest about ourselves, and that we also are tempted and we also have a conflict. Really what a little bit of what Sinclair was saying this morning about the Holy Spirit's ministry to us. And we're not going to make progress with our people until we can identify with them. All right, we are the minister, and those who teach will be judged with a greater strictness. But there's a need for honesty if they are going to understand Christian living and a biblical doctrine of sanctification, for us to be honest with them within these concentric circles.
Well, I nothing more to add to you. More conceptually put than I have done. Yeah.
I appreciate so very much your emphasis on sharing the congregation. I think that over the years I've benefited very much from the love of the congregation and feel that we've grown very close together in many ways. We have had some dreadful experiences in the past of being friends with people and to some extent opening ourselves up to people and having quite a nice relationship, and then having the whole thing dashed to the ground with people walking out and quite suddenly without sometimes without reasons and sometimes with reasons given. But we've had some, it's left a great amount of hurt at the time. And we've had quite a few of those experiences, not just one or two over the years. Not recently, I'm happy to say, but it tends to make us very cautious.
I mean, I don't know how much you want me to respond to that. I mean, I would agree entirely. But Paul had exactly the same experience. How many parents have felt the children have hurt them, and you forgive, and then they learn and come back? Hmm? And I would have to say that a lot of my therapy in dealing with just, you know, secular situations is enabling people to deal with the hurts, the injuries, the betrayals, as they've perceived it, from childhood, within marriage, work, and so on. How can we expect it to be other than that within the church when you're dealing with fallen men and women? It's how we respond to that which shows whether the grace of God is operative within our fellowship. It's not that we don't expect this to happen. It will happen. It's how we actually respond to that that says there is something different here.
But wouldn't you need to know why they do that?
Well, I would, but yeah. I mean, do you want to comment on that yourself?
Yeah. I mean, I think one can rationalise this very much, and that the Word of God obviously convicts, and inevitably one was preaching one. I think there's a conflict I see a conflict between the work of being a pastor preaching the word and at the same time being a friend. I think it's very difficult to be just a friend with people because you're a pastor too.
Yeah.
And you have to preach from the pulpit, and people get hurt from the pulpit, and then you have to be friends with them, and they give you a back again, you know.
Yeah.
Which is, I mean, it's human nature, but it's... I mean, I'm quite helped by the fact that you say that it's part of human life, and that's fine. I mean, it helps even to understand that. But I mean, I think it's a fact of life. This conflict between being one of the boys. I had a group within the church many years ago who wanted me to be alongside them and to be one of them. But they seemed to be the purpose of that was to try and prevent me from being the pastor and challenging. And I think there's a conflict there.
I think that's true. There is a conflict, the same as there is with a parent and child, the same as there is with a friend. So there is that tension, and it's to sort of, some people will go at it bang, and others will, you know, weave the way to it more gently, and that's a temperamental thing to some extent. But I mean, it's quite true, when the Word of God really begins to touch people, then there'll be a reaction, and you may be the person that cops it. But don't just accept that that's automatically all that's to be said, because sometimes our whole way of doing it could have been done differently. I never forget one of my junior doctors, who was a Christian, who said, "Monty, why do you say the things you say in the way you do?" And of course, he was speaking from an English context, and I am a Scot, and you know, we have a certain abrasiveness, perhaps, and directness. And my wife heard me on the phone once, and she said, "Look, you can't do it that way down here." And I said, "Why not? It's the truth." She said, "Yes, yes, yes, but..." Those of you who know me well, I'm told I've mellowed over the years, but...
A bit, yeah.
Well, I'm glad to hear that even the Spirit of God can work even with me, but there we are. But I think we must say, is there a way in which we've done this wrongly? And I never forget a colleague who in a committee really let rip. I was chairing. And I made some comment. I said, "No, there's a matter of principle here." And this person, who was very opposed to many of the things which I stood for in lots of ways, really, "You always make things a matter of principle," and then really gave me my character in no uncertain terms and so on. in public. And fortunately, he went on so long that my temper went up and came down again. And I really do feel that was part of the Lord's provision. Because I would have lost any testimony if I had responded, you know, as I was smart. And then I went away afterwards and I said, well, I'll leave my colleagues to judge whether you speak truthfully or otherwise, and went on to the next business. But then I thought, yes, but I do sometimes make a matter of principle. And then don't say, and where do we go from there? That I almost use the principle as a sort of battering ram against those who may not see it from my point of view. And I learnt something from that, and those words rang in my ears for years afterwards. And I think when we do get that reaction, don't automatically feel that this is just the gospel. It may be there's a way in which we've done it. And why did we choose to offload to these people? Maybe we did it in an insensitive way. We didn't ask to support them. There are so many ways in which we can react to that.
But Monty, aren't there people who accept the friendship of the minister and can do so for years, and yet inwardly they're fuming against the gospel, and it goes on until they can't stand it anymore?
Yes.
Is that the kind of thing that you think was behind?
Maybe.
They need your friendship, but they don't like the gospel that goes with it. But there are many people within fellowships drawn to the warmth. Yes, drawn to the warmth, but they don't like where that warmth is coming from.
That's exactly it.
Can I ask about growing together? Because I haven't been quite 5 years in my fellowship yet. But one of the problems I find is a couple of times we've begun to grow, both my wife and myself, grow close to people. There seems to be a point at which is thus far and no further. And we don't only simply reach that point, but having reached that point, there's almost a withdrawal from it, like a fear of getting close to the minister and wife. And it's quite difficult for us to make those kinds of friendships. We found difficult once or twice in that kind of aspect.
You mean you feel a fear about going further?
No.
They feel a fear.
If you got that close, then they begin to withdraw.
Yeah. No, I think that's absolutely. I mean, other people, I'm sure, would reiterate that they fear if they go too far, then they lose you as a minister, or maybe they feel they're inferior in some way, that you might get too close to them. I don't know. Maybe that's just something which you have to think about, pray about, and maybe preach a little bit about, that you'd look for a way of getting round that barrier. I don't know what kind of parish you come from, but I'm sure there are quite strong cultural barriers sometimes to getting too close to ministry. And don't forget, many of these people may have an experience in the past which makes them wary of going further. But that's the sort of thing which I think you just acknowledge, you put aside and say, well, maybe there's no more we can do just now. And then something happens in 2 years, 5 years, and maybe something which you wouldn't like happens, which enables them suddenly to care for you in a different sort of way, be open to something. We can sometimes push things further than, you know, we can be even too impatient sometimes.
Do you see there's nothing like having a baby in the mouth to enable some of that friendship to occur? I've been in parish ministry now for 3.5 years just, and have begun to see friendships building among the congregation and between some of them and myself, and that's been good. But I would like to comment on what you said on fraternals earlier. When I came to Dundee, the fraternal to which I was invited fairly soon collapsed. I don't think it was a formal fraternal of the kind of which you were referring to. But informal fraternals, if you like, informal relations with local ministers, have been a growing source of friendship, support, enabling and encouraging me to a great extent in Dundee, and I appreciated that. I would caution against just throwing away the friendship and the support that we can gain so much from relationships with others, colleagues round about us. And I think that's an area where we can learn to be vulnerable, open, sharing, and committed and supportive of each other.
I would entirely endorse that. I didn't mean to encourage you to throw that away. By all means have those, and many have been very effective. And this has grown out of that. But what I was saying was, be careful of becoming dependent upon it, which then prevents you looking for it elsewhere as well. No, I agree. I was suggesting we need a re-examination of it. Yeah, go on.
You were doing more than that, I think. But I agree that I think there are many values in the long-term ministry. But the fact is that most people find it exceedingly difficult to sustain. I think that is a fact. And I wonder if you could say a little more about how we can support long-term ministries. Being the support, the keeping long-term ministries fresh, and I think mutual support here is very important. Now, could you perhaps unpack that a little bit and tell us how we can encourage people who would like to be long-term and who would want to have an ongoing, deepening relationship with their congregation, not just over 10 or even 15 years, but much longer. But it seems to me that we can only do that in the majority of cases if, in fact, there are support mechanisms in place which are going to help to keep people fresh, to keep them stimulated, and to simply keep them enthusiastic.
Fair enough, Fergus. I mean, part of asking the likes of me to talk about this, part of having a fellowship like this is giving the support to people who may feel, now, how do I get through this sort of barrier, this time of difficulty or whatever? So, I mean, I think that's part of it. This particular talk came out of a challenge which I was given, I think, by, where is he, Gordon Jenkins? Not here, is he? Oh, yes, there he is. Who asked me to come and speak to a group of ministers on the whole question of the long-term ministry. I think that's right, isn't it? Team ministries on one occasion and long-term ministries on another. So it was that made me sort of think about it. So I think, A, raising the issue helps. Having someone to look at the sort of dynamics of it in the way I've suggested. I think having something like the Creef Fellowship, where you have those who have been involved in longer term ministries available to give models and encouragement. But again, at the end of the day, I think you have to have essential support from the congregation where you're actually ministering. And the major problem is that you feel that you've run out of ideas. Now, unless you've got an ongoing structure within the congregation which feeds back ideas, comments, to which you can bounce off things, then I think you are in real trouble when it comes to long-term ministry. So what I would suggest is that you really have to have this in mind. Can I raise the group? Can I find the group here within this congregation who are going to support my being here on a longer term basis? Because if not, then maybe that is not the place where you do a longer term. But you've got to look for it. Now, in our own fellowship, we would certainly have a yearly review of what has happened within the church. What is actually happening to the population of the church? We would actually see how many people had become new Christians. What was the demography of the church? We would look at people's response to the preaching, what they felt was necessary. We would actually ask for far more information back from the fellowship. And out of this has usually come something which we have not seen, which then gives us the opportunity to discuss that, which then has become a major thing. Now, let's just take again my own example, because I'm thinking aloud a bit with you. It's the annual church meetings, which maybe once every 3 or 4 years has thrown up something which sounded ridiculous at the time, but we've gone away and thought about it prayed about it, discussed it, and it has often been something which we're then being able to bring back to the church, which gives them the feeling of, yes, this is something which you take on in addition to just the ordinary pastoral work. Now, that happened with the whole question of our missionary support. The whole question of our giving to the diocese. I mean, I don't know, do you grind under the presbytery dues or assembly dues? Yes. Well, we're almost £200,000 which we're now expected to give. That's an enormous sum of money. And when you see how it's being spent, you sometimes wonder whether you should. Now, that meant that as a congregation, we really had to begin to think about that. And that did something for the congregation. But you can't really enable a congregation to think through that in a constructive way. What it then meant was that people from the congregation began to say, well, maybe we should get onto the diocesan boards and so on, and begin to look at who's actually structuring the finance boards and so on of the diocese or whatever it is that you have. So I think it's this idea of being alert, being open, giving the opportunity for things to come back, and having a body which can chew over that, pray over that, discuss that, and then take it back to the congregation. Now, I don't think a long-term ministry can operate other than in that sort of context. I'm thinking of John Stott. I mean, the structures of All Souls changed enormously over the years. Dick Lucas, I can't speak so much for. I'm thinking of a church in one that you've never heard of, Stoke Bishop Parish Church, which has seen real changes in the 25 years the vicar was there in Bristol. But again, he had a group of people that he gathered round with whom he prayed, discussed, who fed back to him things from the congregation, which alerted them to things which maybe they should think of. So there was an ongoing agenda all the time which was challenging. I mean, do you have other ideas? I mean, you're out in a parachurch organization.
I appreciate all that you've said about having such support from within the congregation. But the fact is that many of us are in congregations where it's very difficult to have that kind of support.
Right.
And I think that in addition to such support where it's available, we do need support from one another. And as I understand it, presbyteries were originally designed to provide this, but of course they've sadly lapsed from that ideal. But the idea of having a regular meeting with people who, in addition to those within your congregation, with people who are involved in the same kind of work, and you're exchanging ideas, you're exchanging information on the basis of your reading, not just theological reading, but reading about, you know, what's happening in society, where things are going. I think that these kind of things can greatly stimulate people and help people to go on to preach, you know, the same message of the gospel, but in an enriched way, and contextualizing it in a new way as, you know, as society finds itself in a different situation. That's just one way as I see it, but I'm sure there are others.
Yeah, okay. I'm just thinking, in England, certainly you have what they call eclectics, which are the younger evangelical ministers under the age of 40, founded by John Stott, actually. One or two other people. You can't be in it if you're over the age of 40. So the old boys don't dominate the scene. And that has certainly been a real ginger group and encouraging group for some. And then there's the senior evangelical Anglican clergy, because once they go over 40, they find that they still needed to meet. And that again is a way in which they stimulate, and there is a bit of cross-fertilization from these two groups. CPAS, Church Pastoral Aid Society, has actually begun to produce some very good material for ministers and congregations where you don't have the kind of resources I'm talking about, for looking at the whole way in which families can be helped. And they produce some very excellent material. I don't know whether you see it up in Scotland, but it's certainly comparable with some of the best material I've seen from other bodies. So yes, I totally agree that there are these other fraternals of a sort, which I've not decried. I just say don't become totally dependent on them.
Dr. Barker, perhaps a word about the accusation which I've received in my ministry, from one elder at least, of favoritism, because I think there can be a certain amount of resentment, not necessarily properly based, but if you look for people to open up to, there may be others that don't particularly want you to open up to them, but they'll resent you opening up to someone else.
That's a very good question.
I don't think you'll ever be able to avoid the criticism of favoritism. Because there are those who perceive favoritism where there is none whatsoever. And if you're not being favorites with them, then the assumption is that you must be favorites with somebody else anyway, even if they don't see it. Now, you know, I don't think you can ever get out of that kind of, the possibility of that sort of situation. What I think you have to do is try and be as friends as much as you can with as many people as you can. Now, I think there is a pattern which I see, I don't know whether it happens in Scotland, of certain people being invited to dinner and other people who are not. In England, there is a kind of stratification that there are those that you invite for tea, those you invite for lunch, and those you invite for dinner. And you only invite your equals for dinner, the people who are quite nice people, but not quite, for lunch, and your inferiors for tea. Now, there must be some Scottish equivalent of that somewhere, which I've forgotten. And I think there is a danger of doing that. And the people who have avoided this most are the people who have avoided that kind of the dinner fraternity sort of situation. So I think you have to look at your own cultural situation in the parish where you are and then say, now, what are the things here where I can show as much friendship as possible to as wide a group of people? And when you do have those people from whom you specially draw, with whom you specially change, try and make it in a context which doesn't actually indicate that these are the superior people of the parish. Now, I can't, again, dictate that for you. But sometimes coming around for coffee or you know, whatever it is, might be appropriate. But I think some ministers can be quite, I think, lacking in understanding by having the sort of dinner fraternity or whatever it is, or the supper fraternity and the others.
I was just thinking that one of the criterions for special friendship with folk within the congregation is that they accept that it should be as little seen and known by the congregation as possible.
Mm. Yeah.
It follows on, in a sense, from Carl's question. It's about the dynamics of the impact of a leadership group forming on other people. Not necessarily on individuals, but on what was the impact on the PCC of a leadership group forming which included others than the PCC? To what extent can we cultivate our Kirk Sessions, which is an existing body which has a degree of authority and a relationship with us? The other direction of impact was, and I don't know if your vicar is married, but on his wife, if he is, where did she fit in? How did she feel about it? What happened to her particular role in the minister and his relationship with the congregation, and what happened to her relationship with the congregation?
Good. No, excellent. You're absolutely right that when you have a group like that, there is the feeling of there are the sort of the in ones, you know, those who are far ben and those who are not. And this did become a problem at one point. And we resolved that by saying, all right, we will publish in the magazine what we discuss. And the PCC will know what the agenda was. That doesn't mean that everything that was discussed was put into formal minutes. But no decisions were made by that group which did not come to the PCC. And I think that's absolutely important, that there's an openness, there is an overtness, because it's what people think is going on that they don't know about that really gets them worried. They don't want to be part of it. For goodness sake, meeting every fortnight for prayer, woo, don't want that, thank you. but they want to know that there's nothing going on there that they don't have access to. So we dealt with that by becoming far more open about it. Not that we wanted to be secret in the first place, but that people did get that. Now, what happened with regard to the Constitution was, when, 20 years ago, the number of people within the Church Council who really were, who had an understanding of the gospel was very few. Let me not make any comments about whether they were Christians or not, that's not the point, but who had an understanding of what the ministry really was for, there were very few. Now we have a church council which will pray together. There was no concept of praying together 20 years ago. So that must be something which gradually evolves. And I think you just have to see what your own structures are here to try and enable that. With regard to the vicar's wife, well, it was actually a problem for the wives of the other people as well. It wasn't just the vicar's wife. Because our wives were excluded. In fact, we had a situation where if there was somebody on the church council, the spouse could not be on the church council. So my wife, who could well have been on the church council, and the wives of several of the other people in the church council, and the husbands of some of the other people in church council, were excluded automatically because their spouse was on. So there is a problem here. I don't know how you get around that one, except that our spouses accepted that this was a limitation for the sake of the whole congregation, for the sake of the integrity of this body. And I think that has worked. It has prevented it becoming a situation dominated by several families. So that was a willing sacrifice on the part of the people involved in order to prevent misunderstanding and criticism. But it was openly discussed. I cannot say that it wasn't without a certain ruefulness on the part of some. But one looked for other ways in which those people's contribution could be used. I don't know whether that answers your questions or gives a little bit of...
Yes, it does. I just have this horror vision of your vicar having huge vows with his wife, or of her telling him, you know, where do I fit in, where's my contribution, and all that kind of thing. And, you
okay.
know,
in fact, he's had two wives. The first one died, and died of a very, very unpleasant cancer. She herself gave immense support, but did not wish to be involved in the running of the parish, but was totally behind him and, you know, in everything that was going, but did not take active leadership roles. In fact, she took the kind of roles that other people didn't want. His second wife,